Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
If you know the writer Paul Theroux, you probably know him from his great travel writing. In books like The Great Railway Bazaar, he took us through Asia and Africa, the Mediterranean, Central and South America. And it was never traditional travel writing. It was always a story in which his mind, his character, and his encounters with others was the main thing. He's lively, he's acerbic, just like his mentor V.S. Naipaul. But his new book features a landscape of an entirely different variety.
A nation is defined usually as like-minded people. Malawi is a nation. Kenya is a nation. A family can be a nation, too. They not only have, you know, they're in one place and there are a lot of them, but they develop their own rituals, their own rites, and they even have their own language, proverbs, expressions, ways of complimenting each other, ways of abusing each other. So they develop this national structure, something like a nation. And then usually there's someone in charge. Always there's someone in charge. In this case, it's mother.
The book is called Motherland, and it's set in Theroux's hometown of Medford, Massachusetts, in a large family of siblings. They're all adults, but they fight like kids. The father has died as the book begins, and the mother, she's known in the book only as Mother, is doing everything she can to hold on to her power. Paul Theroux spoke with fiction editor Deborah Treisman.
The family as it was constituted before is reconstituted as motherland, where the mother's in charge and the children are very contentious, very rancorous, and it's all partly slapstick and partly, I suppose, cruelty. And then there's a kind of cohesiveness about this rancor, too.
Yeah, I was going to say when you said they're a nation of like-minded people, that these particular characters are very rarely like-minded in the book. They spend a lot of it arguing.
Yes, they do, but they need to argue. The mother in the book rewards them. I mean, she has ways of keeping power. And I realized that writing it, that the mother resembles a lot of the dictators that I've seen in my life come and go. Chairman Mao, you know, you think about Stalin, Pol Pot. I was thinking how the mother finds out the techniques of maintaining power by whispering, gossiping, creating dissension in order to keep power, much as Stalin or Chairman Mao or someone else would have done.
Right. When I think about sort of versions of motherhood, I rarely think of Chairman Mao and Stalin.
When you think of a particular version. When you think about power, though, how do you maintain power? You maintain power by using secrets, withholding information, disparaging one person, setting one against another. That the worst thing that can happen for a dictator is that people become united against him or her.
Yeah. Now, the main or narrator in the book, JP, is a writer, and he describes Mother as his muse at one point. How does that work? I mean, has she been his muse?
Yes, I think so. I think that I've thought about a lot about how you become a writer, how people become writers. I mean, the contrast would be between an Olympic swimmer or a gymnast and a poet or a writer. The Olympic swimmer is always talking about how his mother drove him to practice at 4 o'clock in the morning to use the pool to swim 2 hours before school starts. And then when the Olympic medal is awarded, there's always a very touching, tender speech about how she deserves the medal as much as he does. You see where I'm going with it. Mm-hmm. So someone wins the Pulitzer or the National Book Award or the Nobel Prize, and they rarely talk about how the mother made a sacrifice. Usually it's someone who's been rebelling against the mother.
So do you think that's that your mother was what made you a writer?
Well, I don't know. To a certain extent, this book is autobiographical. So incidents in the book happened in my family. Probably the more bizarre ones actually happened and the more conventional ones didn't. Did my mother make me a writer? I think my mother drove me away from home. I mean, I wasn't happy in this big family. And I fantasized about going away. So I think going away made me a writer. My mother really wanted me to go away. When I told my parents that I was going to Africa, their faces were wreathed in smiles. I said, I'm going away for 2 years. Nyasaland, Central Africa. My father said, that's great. My mother said, that's wonderful. I'm so proud of you. But they were also kind of relieved. Well, here's one. We won't have to worry about him. Worry about him, but we won't have to feed him.
When you have seven children, it probably doesn't hurt to have one or two leave.
No, they can concentrate on the others. But so my mother is not the mother in this book, although she somewhat resembles it. It's based on my life without being my life.
Mm-hmm. There's an early chapter in the book in which we see Jay's father, who dies at the beginning of the book, but it's a flashback called Mr. Bones, which was actually in The New Yorker in 2007. And we get a vision of the father who had a brief stint as a minstrel show performer. And I think, yes, at the time you mentioned that was drawn from life.
The germ of it was in the 1950s, which is when it's set, early 50s, white American men put on blackface and sang plantation songs. It happened all over the United States and even in England. But the idea of putting on blackface and singing Mandy, is there a minister handy, and sure would be dandy, that kind of thing, mocking, but, you know, in a jolly way, mocking black life, black plantation life. Very, very strange. I remember it distinctly. My father did it 2 years in a row. I found it acutely embarrassing. Even then, I was only maybe 10 years old, but I found it strange. I found it shame-making, embarrassing, mm-hmm. Horrible. But my father enjoyed it. It meant he could sing. He liked to sing, and he had his pals, and they all had names like Sambo and Mr. Bones. And my father really did have two distinct sides to his personality. One was very quiet side and one was a joking side. So I use that to describe how when he's in blackface, he becomes a rebel, a mocker, a satirist. You know, one thing that the novel does is create its place in history and tells you about its time. So I was happy to sort of use this incident, which has a historical precedent, and then show how it plays out within the family, in the family dynamic.
There's a great paragraph in Motherland where Jay, I'll just read a few lines of it. It says, "It must have seemed that I was writing stories, book reviews, novels, travel books, magazine articles, essays, newspaper columns, more novels, more stories, another travel book. But it was not an unsorted stack of vagrant scribbles. It was, in words, a sort of edifice. What I was doing was giving form to a continuous account of my existence, my disappointments and obsessions, my reading, my secrets, writing every day. All these books and pieces could be laid end to end as a long linking account of who I was." Do you think that's an accurate account of your own history?
Yeah, that's it, really. It's not writing stories to amuse people or to rally the troops or anything. It's just to make sense of my little life, where I've been, what I'm doing, what's on my mind. And yeah, that's called a writing career, I guess.
There were a couple of other chapters in the book that appeared in The New Yorker as stories. And the first one was The Best Year of My Life, which came out in 2005. Jay and his college girlfriend, she gets pregnant and they go to Puerto Rico to keep their parents from finding out. But Jay in the story or in the novel says, it was my first experience of the way travel turns you into a new person. And there's a sense that travel has become his escape from family. Do you think that was part of what it was for you?
Yes. And what I think is that travel makes you the person that you really are. As soon as I began to travel, I thought, this is it. I like this. And especially I wanted to go to unfamiliar places. I wanted to go to places that were, the exotic names, Zanzibar, Patagonia, Mongolia. As soon as I heard a name, Bhutan, I wanted to go there for the name alone, often. And then when I went, you make discoveries. And what sustains you in travel is that discovery.
And that story involved this young couple giving up this baby for adoption. And he pops up later as an adult in the book. And Jay becomes or gets to know him at that point.
Yes. The suggestion perhaps behind your comment is, did this happen? It did happen, actually, when I was very young. My girlfriend got pregnant. The child was put up for adoption. Much later in life, the child popped up. I mean, and it was so satisfying and so wonderful. I thought that happened before I began the book, but I was trying to think, how can I write this? You know, how? And so I had to kind of live it and then write it.
Yeah. Have people in your family read the book? Your siblings?
Not only have they not read, if that, I don't have any evidence that they've read much of what I've written. So no, and it's a very odd thing because it's so easy to know someone through their work, and mm-hmm. particularly through a play, a poem, a story, a novel. It's a good way of knowing someone, knowing their tastes and knowing their mind. But certainly in Hawaii, I'm just this guy. I don't really, I have no presence here as a writer. I never meet people who read anything that I've written. I mean, that's just the way things go.
Well, it must be kind of liberating.
You know, it is. It is. It's like being a ghost. And the great thing about being a ghost is that no one sees you, but you see everything. My nephew, Justin, who's married to Jennifer Aniston, is driven insane by people who want to take his picture. And, you know, and he's very envious of me and my anonymity.
It probably comes in handy with the travel writing as well.
Very much so. Very much so. And when you're older, I mean, no one looks at an older person. They think, you probably don't have any money. I'm not going to rob you. You're kind of invisible. It's a wonderful thing.
Well, thank you so much, Paul.
Deborah, it's a pleasure talking to you.
You too.
Paul Theroux's new book is Motherland. He spoke with New Yorker fiction editor Deborah Treisman. Theroux has published many, many stories in The New Yorker, and you can find them all at newyorkerradio.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.